I speak to you in the name of God. Amen. Last Tuesday, I celebrated my 73rd birthday. It was a lovely day. On last Sunday night, we had dinner at my house. We draped the red tablecloth on our dining table, put out all the china, crystal, and sterling, and I made pasta. My birthday is one of 2 days a year. My granddaughter Claire allows me to make pasta. So we ate and feasted and enjoyed ourselves. The day before this big dinner, I celebrated my birthday the way I have done since I was 40, by swimming my age. This year, we also had a swimathon to support Episcopal Relief and Development. Thanks to my swimming partner, Tom Dixon, and all of you who pledged to support us, we will collect, I think, about $2,500 to support our church's projects around the world to bring clean water to those who lack it. It seems somehow redemptively ironic to raise money for clean water by swimming through gallons of clean water. I was born in Fort Myers, Florida, the second child and first son of a young Methodist minister and his wife. Incredibly, the news of my birth took 2 years to reach the United Nations. But when it did, the assembled representatives of Manhattan's East Side celebrated by issuing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on December 10, 1948. Ever since, that day has marked both my birth and Human Rights Day around the world. Just add the numbers. This year is the 71st anniversary of that great collective cry of the nations, and it hardly seems possible to add more luster to this illustrious day. But on this third Sunday of Advent, we have stumbled across Isaiah's vision of a resplendent wilderness and the homecoming of creation. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, the desert shall rejoice and blossom, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy. Now you don't need to be clairvoyant to know that there's a great gulf between the way the world is and the way it ought to be. This gulf certainly stretches across my personal history. It extends over political and economic events, and it opens a chasm between our theological past and our future. I know the most about my own life. Having now fathered two children of my own, I remember what hopes and promise lay in those 7 or 8 pounds of new person, genetically programmed for some things, destined to reenact family histories for the umpteenth time, bearing expectations and longings of many generations. How quickly things go awry. Parents read the books and try their best. They clothe, they feed, they teach, they exhort. They hold their breath, they watch and they wait. They love and they help. And in 73 years, I have become who I am. It's not exactly what anyone would have thought on December 10, 1946. I've surpassed some expectations and failed other expectations. Some days I feel as if I'm just now becoming the person I could have been. Other days I'm just tired of trying. But even on my best, most sparkling days, I fear there's still a great gap between what is and what could be. When the United Nations celebrated my second birthday, it published ringing words of peace and justice and human dignity. If you remember, the world was just recovering from the barbarism of a world war, the madness of genocide, and the banal arrogance of atomic bombs. Feeling perhaps as if the long climb out of the mud had to begin anew, delegates to the United Nations passed a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It is a wide-ranging, rambling, perhaps inherently contradictory affirmation of the fundamental freedom and dignity of persons. Here's a partial list of its articles. The right to life, liberty, and security of person. Freedom from slavery. Freedom from torture. Freedom from discrimination. Presumption of innocence. Freedom of thought, conscience, and expression. The right to social security. The right to work. The right to equal pay for equal work. The right to an adequate standard of living. The right to an education. It's an impressive list. I have a large, about this big, laminated, framed copy of the Declaration, which hangs on the wall of my study at home. For 10 years, it hung prominently in my law office to remind me that under all the court appearances, the trials, the applications for asylum, the motions, and all the bureaucratic hassling, I was dealing with persons who possessed inherent dignity and worth. It's an impressive list, but its publication admits that the world isn't as it ought to be. And 71 years later, the world still isn't as it ought to be. Since the rights claimed in the Declaration are not legally enforceable by any international authority, our own country has never signed them, the Soviet Union didn't sign them, Islamic countries published their own Declaration of Rights, nations continue to weave ironic and troubling patterns with chemical warfare, rape, murder, and genocide in Syria, continuing denial of basic rights in Cuba, North Korea, and other rogue nations, hate killings in Jersey City and all over our country. But human beings are wonderfully resilient in the face of a broken world. With a little time and encouragement, we usually try to fix it. Other than an occasional sore shoulder from swimming without warming up, I feel pretty good at 73, except for my poor knees. I'm ready to spend more years trying to fulfill the hope and promise that lay bright and breathless those many years ago. We certainly keep trying to fix the world of nations. Seasons of despair and distrust are interrupted by feast days of hope. When Desmond Tutu, whom I've spoken to personally, can vote at my age for the first time in his life. And human rights hold fast some places where once they were buried. And resilient and determined people all over the world work for peace and justice against deadly odds and inept bureaucracies. A teenage girl with autism rails against the nations for wasting our island home, our earth. But I believe the church sings Isaiah's song of the restoration of Zion on this third Sunday of Advent, precisely because we're so resilient and determined. For peace and justice always arrive as a gift from God. The human rights and dignity, which we promise to respect in our baptismal vows, so gloriously extolled in the Declaration, are placed in us by our Maker. And despite righteous passion and personal determination, we are likely on our own to make only small shortenings of the great gulf between the world as it is and the world as it ought to be. Therefore, in order not to give up or give in, we need an icon of the world restored. We need, as we listen to John rasping in judgment and dripping with chastisement, we need to believe that the one who comes, the one with uncarried sandals, the one who radiates light and heat, the one in whose presence the wounded are healed and the poor have good news brought to them, we need to believe that that one will guide our task with hope and fill us with glory. If we turn to John's forerunner, John the forerunner of Jesus, if we turn to John's forerunner, to Isaiah, we witness the blessing of the barren wasteland, which haunts us still today. In the past 2 weeks, we have heard two of the great canticles of blessing and peace. On that day, keep sounding in our ears. It's a great Advent cry. On that day, someday, God will put it right. So to the people lost in the wildernesses of Tampa, to the people locked into suburban cul-de-sacs, to the people shot at on our main streets in our city, to African Americans impatient with official and unofficial racism, for newer immigrants far from home and friends, these promises of blossoms and peace, of security and joy, have to convince a little at a time. Long ago, a perpetually discontented Quaker, Edward Hicks, painted a series of peaceable kingdoms. Ever see those paintings? There are a whole series of them. But in the best known of these paintings, there is William Penn under an elm tree, covenanting with Indians. On the other side of the painting are stylized figures from Isaiah, leopards, lions, forest, lambs, and children all together. Now, this painting is logically, historically, and zoologically incongruous. But you know, it works. It just kind of works. All the elements are there. Politics, the natural world, law in the form of a treaty relating disparate people, the harmony of beasts with each other and with humans is aesthetically linked to the politics of the treaty, not as a kind of cause and effect, but as companion parts of the whole. Lest we be seduced by the icon, remember what Woody Allen said. When the lion and the calf lie down together, the calf doesn't get much sleep. Sometimes we can't even see across the gulf that still filaments and fragments our world. So we're not there yet. But the highway is still forming, and a few ravenous beasts still linger around the door. But this is a season of things still to come. Advent. This is still a season of things still to come. Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another? Was John's plaintive question to Jesus. So be patient when necessary, as James reminds us. Work hard when possible. Do the Lord's work at all times. Defend the needy. Rescue the poor and crush the oppressor. And stand tall to watch for the one who comes after John. For at his coming, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, the desert shall rejoice and blossom, the blind shall receive their sight, the lame shall walk, the leper shall be cleansed, the deaf shall hear, the dead shall be raised, and the poor shall have good news brought to them. That is even better than a declaration of human rights. Amen. Amen.